Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thriving Minds podcast. I'm Professor Selena Bartlett. Today, we're joined by another professor, this time of psychology. His name is Nick Haslam. He's from the University of Melbourne. He's got a very impressive CV, but I'm not going to spend too much time reading it out, but you're welcome to look it up. Today, we're going to be talking about his book called Troubled Minds. And I think this is a really excellent subject for us to delve into. So thank you, Nick, for giving us your time today and for all the work you've been doing. Thank you so much.
I'm delighted to be here, Selena. Thanks so much for having me.
Please let us start by telling everyone about what inspired you to write your book, Troubled Minds, with Dr. Block.
Well, I do need to be clear that Sid Block, who's a very esteemed senior psychiatrist who was editor of the Australian New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry for many years, is really the main instigator here. And he brought me on as a kind of junior partner. He'd had previous books of a similar nature, also with Troubled Minds in the title, going back a decade or so. And what he tried to do in those earlier books was give a kind of panoramic view of the mental health landscape as he saw it. And he was someone who, like us, Selena, was quite international. He'd spent time at Oxford. He'd spent time at Stanford. He's very much global. But he wanted a book with an Australian perspective that gave this overview of mental health. And we just thought it was about time to have another go at it, to have something more updated. And to Sid's credit, to have it written not only by someone with a psychiatry background, but also someone with a psychology background, such as myself, because psychiatrists and psychologists don't always see things eye to eye. And so I think it's a sign of Sid's openness that he was keen to get my perspective on things. So I think in general, he just wanted to write something that was accessible, authoritative, representing, decades of combined contribution, that wasn't pushing a particular barrow, theoretically speaking, but was really just saying, here's what mental ill health looks like. Here's what can be done about it as a guide for people in general.
I have to say you're an excellent writer.
Because I think
I've read a lot of them in, your pieces, reviews in Inside Story and others, and I feel like you really like writing.
Yeah, look, sorry to interrupt just then. I think it's really important to find a way of communicating that works for you. And some people are just excellent at, live radio or podcasts. I'm not sure I'm in that category yet, but I just like the written word. I think books are wonderful. I've taken time to get better at it. And I think you have to unlearn some bad habits when you're doing writing for The Conversation or Inside Story or other magazines, because academic writing, as you very well know, tends to be pretty starchy, pretty stiff, a lot of obscure language, a lot of long sentences. So I have tried quite hard, especially through The Conversation, where I've got about 70 articles by now, to just learn how to be more accessible, more punchy, more clear. But I appreciate that positive feedback.
Yeah. I encourage everyone to read some of the stories. They're really quite thoughtful, but really well written. So let's just delve into Troubled Minds for a little bit. In that book, you're discussing a wide range of mental illnesses, but you've really picked a few. Do you want to talk about how you chose those and why?
Sure. Yeah, look, I think we tried to be pretty expansive. So we, as you say, there are some we spend more time on than others, but really we try to cover the most common forms of mental health problems. So, just so your listeners know, spend a good deal of time on mood, on depression and bipolar disorder, a lot of time on anxiety and trauma and the different forms they take. Quite a bit of time as well on problems with a more bodily kind of focus. So functional neurological disorder are getting a lot of attention these days, body dysmorphia. We spent some time on a variety of eating problems, psychoses, problems specific to older people, some developmental conditions. Really, it's more what we didn't include than what we did, to be frank. We tried to be really inclusive, and look, we left out some things. We didn't talk about disorders of sexuality, didn't have much to say about gender dysphoria, things in that kind of space. But really, it's more what we didn't talk about than what we did. We tried to cover the ground as we saw it.
So I think it's wonderful that we cross scopes of practice, if you want to call it that. Or I think it's so important as we move into a mental health awareness, but also crisis since the pandemic, et cetera, that we have to start working across these silos. I think that's so critically important for people in our society, isn't it? Because they can't get help, actually. That's the main thing I'm hearing. It's very hard to get to see somebody. And people are afraid because, and you talk a lot about this on your website, your primary interest is stigma. So shall we delve a little bit into that subject about crossing boundaries and what was the common ground that you and Sid came to, even though you're in different professions?
Yeah, look, I think our common ground is that we just value breadth. We're open to different perspectives. We're not, we don't share all our views, but we just try to be broadly humanistic. So Sid is a sort of has a real interest in psychotherapy. And in more existential forms of psychotherapy, so meaning in life. He's always been a great proponent of medical humanities. He makes sure that medical students aren't only learning about bodies and biochemistry, but also learning about theatre and art and literature. And so I think we think that sort of breadth is really important, and that was our common ground. So rather than pushing a particular theoretical or therapeutic orientation, we just say, ultimately, care is a human activity. And there are various ways in which it can be done, and we don't rule out any in particular. So Sid knows a lot about psychopharmacology. I don't. I'm not so interested in that or so expert in it, but simply showing the range of things. Because as you say, I mean, there are lots of silos. And look, there's a place for silos. There's a place for reading a book or a podcast or whatever about a very specific topic. There are lots of books out there about depression, about anxiety, about trauma, about bulimia. And we just thought, the goal of our book would be a bit different, and maybe not quite so deep into each one of these things, but trying to cover more ground. But what you said about access to treatment is certainly troubling. I mean, there has been so much more suffering out there since COVID. And look, I think rates of mental health problems were drifting upward even without that. And for a variety of reasons, getting attention, professional attention, seeking help has been really challenging. A lot of people with full wait lists turning people away, a lot of people having to struggle to get access to professionals. I think we don't really have any systemic solutions to any of that, but I think knowledge is really important. Simply having some sort of knowledge that this problem I have is not unique to me. Other people have it. There are ways of understanding it. There are ways of treating it. Help is possible. There is a community of other people similar to me. Even if I'm not currently getting help, I can now find the help that, or look for the kind of help that will be beneficial to me. And we hope that readers of the book will feel encouraged, feel hopeful, and maybe be more educated consumers of mental health care.
Yes, and as my experience in my own family, which you may not be aware of, but, you know, I became a neuroscientist because my sister was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 89 and ended up in a terrible situation. But our family felt very alone in that whole journey. And I think that's what we're trying to change, isn't it? We're trying to make people feel less alone, that it's a family problem, a family secret, and something that can't be helped by the society in general, finding places to support this rather than having to hide it because of the stigma attached to it. I think that's something that you want to break down as well.
For sure. I think we all want to break that down. And look, I think there's some evidence that things are getting better in many areas. So I think there's certainly a growing awareness. And most population surveys do show that there's a kind of downward trend in levels of stigma. That's not to say it's gone away. There's still shame felt by people with mental health problems. There's still a lot of desire to avoid those who are suffering. There's still some dangerous stereotypes that people with mental health problems are dangerous or unpredictable. All of these things persist, but I think on average, things are better, largely as a result of spreading awareness. So the struggles you've gone through, one would hope they're not quite so prevalent now as they might have been in the late 80s. Having said that, it's not all good news, and I think it's especially less good news for the more severe mental health problems. So again, some of the work that's been done in Europe and also here that finds that there's less stigma now attached to, say, depression or eating disorders or anxiety, don't find the same reductions in attitudes towards schizophrenia. And in fact, they have often gotten worse. You know, so while there's been this very beneficial spread of awareness and spread of understanding and knowledge, and people at least superficially saying that they feel sort of more open and more hopeful, more willing to share the community with people who are suffering, it hasn't always extended to those who've got the more disabling conditions.
Yes. So let's talk about how you like using stories of people you've treated in the book. How do personal narratives help in understanding mental health better, do you think?
I think it's so crucial just to see what it actually feels and looks like. Stories are much more capable of enlisting our empathy than textbooks. And I don't know about your experience, Selena, but I know when I was an undergraduate, I was fascinated by the clinical psychology, or what was then called abnormal psychology material. But when you're reading descriptions of DSM conditions and lists of symptoms, you don't really get a sense of what this looks like. And it often has this sense it's something kind of exotic and weird and rare, and almost as if you're reading about sort of rare birds in some jungle in the Amazon rather than actual human beings living among you. And so the stories, I think, really help capture that. I think it's a shame in a way that as the mental health disciplines have been more and more scientific, they've kind of dispensed with case studies. Case studies are so interesting. And of course, you can't generalize from a single case study, but you can get a sense of what it looks and feels like. So the anecdotes, the case studies that we've got in this book, they're all very short. They're obviously all carefully made sure to not reveal who the person is. Often they're hybrids of multiple cases. And I should also just say, as someone who hasn't practiced for a very long time, they're almost all from Sid's experience more so than mine. But they're attempts just to sort of put a bit of flesh on the bones of the descriptions that we're giving in the text, just to make it seem real. And I think what often you find when you see the case studies, at least I hope you find this, is that you can identify with it, you can relate to it, you can see it as being, you know, not alien to the human experience, but just a particular form of the human experience. Yeah. I'm a very strong believer of the view that most mental health problems are on a continuum with everyday ordinary experiences. And a lot of my research has been on that as well, sort of showing that really, although we talk about a lot of these mental health problems as if they were distinct categories, as if people who had them were categorically different from the rest of us, in fact, all of these things just about are on a spectrum. And so when you see a case study, you see someone who's troubles may be more significant or severe or lasting or disabling than the ones you personally have or that your family members or friends or acquaintances have, but which are nevertheless relatable and similar. So I think the narratives are really, really, really important. And, you know, you can't really write personal narratives or even narratives of cases in academic writing. So I think those of us who come at this sort of work from the academy, from universities, can really benefit from this stuff.
Absolutely. And I'd love that you keep saying the word human experience. And I really believe that we're on a really revolutionary shift in that direction. Thank goodness, finally, because you can't discount the human experience and its contributions over many generations to where we are today.
Now, and look, my personal interest in psychology didn't come from this at all, frankly. I personally was interested in animals. When I had a beloved uncle who passed away recently, who was a botanist, but who was just personally very interested in butterflies and moths and native bees and collected all sorts of things. And I really, you know, caught the bug from him, you know, pun intended, and just loved the natural world and became a bird watcher. And I thought, look, you know, I could do psychology and study animal behavior. So yeah. My personal story, I'm not sure that's of any.
Well, I think it is, because my previous podcast that I just put out is called is around butterfly effect. And he's talking about anxiety. He runs a really amazing center for people to be able to reach out that are having suicide ideation, et cetera, up in Brisbane. He just moved here from Ireland. His name's Ken. And he talks about that very much so our evolutionary psychology, which is kind of what you're alluding to here, and its contribution to the human experience that we always discount. But I'm sure that's exactly the alignment that you saw.
Sure, yeah. And I think, animal behavior is fascinating, even insects, and the idea that we're all part of this big encompassing nature. And we're different in some ways because we've got language and we've got culture and we've got books and we've got complex societies, but we're also animals. And I gradually sort of lost my interest professionally, at least in animal behavior, and decided that people were pretty fascinating. And that's where it all led. But
As someone interested in animal behavior, you have to allude and tell us the commonality between animals and humans that you've see all the time.
Well, I mean, I think I started off with insects. There's probably not much commonality between butterflies and humans, but I think if you study primates, there's so many similarities with between. Chimps and gorillas and humans. I mean, the amount of caring, the mourning for the dead, the attachment system, the way in which parents, especially mothers, just show such deep concern and care for infants. I mean, the attachment system in humans is obviously really, really fundamental, and it's not demeaning of humans to say that we share that attachment system with primates, other primates. I just think it's part of the depth of it. I mean, part of what I would call our human nature is not what separates us from the natural world, but what links us to the natural world. A lot of our human nature is primate nature, and we've got all this other complex stuff that chimps and gorillas and monkeys don't have. But I think part of what's deep down in us is shared.
Absolutely. Well, we know that through sequencing of our DNA at the very baseline. So let's talk a little bit about your recent conversation article, if that's okay. You wrote about Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal. I actually interviewed Daniel Mate on my podcast, who wrote it with his dad. And tell us like the strengths and weaknesses of that book and how it fits around your book, Troubled Minds.
Yeah, look, I think it's a fascinating book. And for those who haven't come across it, it's quite substantial. And he's got a very powerful voice, because Daniel was involved, as you said, very powerful voice and very inspiring to a lot of people. And essentially what Mare is doing is just saying, look, for a long time, psychiatry and psychology didn't really take seriously the fact that a lot of rotten things happen to people, and a lot of our mental ill health is a result of abuse, neglect, trauma, and that's an incredibly important insight. And he would see the outcomes of trauma occurring in even conditions which usually people don't see it in, for instance, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So everyone knows about PTSD, but Mate would go beyond that and say, look, pretty much every form of mental ill health ultimately is related to the adverse experiences you've suffered in your life. And that's, I think, really important. And he shows how that's relevant to a range of mental health problems. And he also embeds it in a critique of our society. And he goes pretty hard on capitalism, for instance. So it's linked to a whole social justice narrative. And I think all of those things are very attractive for a lot of people. Again, it was a book review, and book reviews aren't supposed to be just saying how wonderful the book is, I think. So I did go in for a bit of critique. I think there's a bit of a one-size-fits-all explanation in his approach, where everything comes trauma. I think he also illustrates an approach which I personally don't agree with much, which is to broaden the concept of trauma to include pretty much any adverse life experience, when I think ideally the word should be limited to the most severe ones. And he tends to, I think, be a little bit dogmatic about not including the fact that there are other factors beyond adverse life experiences that give rise to mental health problems. So I sort of went, I sort of said where I thought he was overstating the case. I think it's a robust disagreement, but at the same time recognizing a very large germ of truth in what he's saying in terms of the importance of childhood, especially adversity.
For the audience listening, the deviation from what you just mentioned there, where you think that there is from the work that you've written in Troubled Minds and you know, the whole field, how do you think it deviates too far in terms of some mental health things that people may not understand?
Well, I mean, again, this actually isn't that relevant to my book with Sid. I mean, we don't really push any particular view about what causes mental health problems. We just say, here's what it looks like, here's the forms it takes, and here's what you might do about it. And look, Mate says some of that stuff as well, but he's primarily saying what is the ultimate source. And the ultimate source for Mate of a lot of our mental health problems is the trauma we experience and the trauma we experience within a toxic culture that promotes trauma and allows trauma to happen and doesn't deal with it successfully. And we're not really taking it. There's no societal critique in our book. It's, you know, we might have critiques of society, but we didn't think they belonged in this particular book. So that's a point of difference. And I think, look, again, we don't really say very much about this in the book. I think it's not that relevant clinically, but I think Mate, for instance, dismisses the role of genetic influences on mental health problems. And, you know, frankly, that's, I think, quite mistaken. There's plenty of evidence that there is age-dedic contribution to every condition, including post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, how badly traumas affect you is partly related to your own biology. I think it's, you just can't deny that. That's not to say it's what a therapist should focus on. I mean, you can't change someone's genes, and so you know you can only address the life experiences the person's had and the psychology they have. But Mate is saying this is what causes mental health problems and this doesn't, and I think both of them do. You don't need to pick a side. You can say there's both life adversity, and we shouldn't underestimate that, as often psychiatry has, and there's psychological and neurobiological and genetic influences. They also matter. We shouldn't dismiss that science. But in terms of troubled minds, we don't push a particular view on that. We just say, you know, in fact, there's very little talk about causation at all in the book. You know, we say a bit about when we think there's a contribution of life experiences or neglect or abuse or trauma or violence or victimization. But it's just not the most important thing we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting thing that is happening, though, that is the Charles Nemiroff just published in Molecular Psychiatry saying, and he's one of the big psychiatrists in the US, as you probably know, around antidepressants and other things. And he just wrote a big review article saying that the DSM-5 needs to be upgraded to include childhood maltreatment as a matter of urgency. So he's not saying it's a primary cause, but he's saying that without that human experience intake in hospitals and clinical settings, then they're missing the point of understanding truly what they're looking at in front of them.
Yeah, and look, it's hard to argue with that. And I think he's not alone. I mean, John Reed, who I wrote with a while ago, who's quite militant about these sort of issues, has made similar points. You know, you're not going to find out the contribution of trauma unless you ask about it, and we need to take it more seriously. I'm in no way disagreeing with the importance of taking these things into account. I'm just saying let's not be as reductionistic about it, about this, and say everything is only about maltreatment and trauma. It's that, but it's also other things as well.
Absolutely. But that's important, isn't it, in all scientific advances? Like once upon a time we all smoked as well. And then we had to upgrade our knowledge and start to take into account it might cause lung cancer, for example.
For sure, yeah. I mean, these things develop. And look, it's always good to have people like Mate or others who make a really passionate case for one kind of thing and make us take notice. Because if you just write books where you just say, everything matters and everything's important, we need to take everything into account, that's a little bit dull. I mean, our book isn't dull. But, you know, it's good to have a few people who take a particular view to an extreme and put it out there. But just when I put my responsible scientist hat on, I say, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
And, I mean, Gabor's work is building off 50 years of, you know, from Bruce McEwen to the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard to, you know, hundreds of scientists, Andrew and Folletti, they're really the founders of this work from 1986 in California, et cetera. So they're building, he's built his work. He's not the only person. It's just that he's taken it to the general audience in a way that's quite, as you said, extreme in some sense, but we have to be really careful too, because what I've noticed, because I've watched all the films, I've read the book, I've interviewed it, because like you, I'm very curious. I want to see what everyone's doing in these spaces. And I think the problem too is when, yes, adverse childhood experiences, childhood maltreatment are definitely facts, but then we can't stay in those facts too for people either for decades to come, because sometimes it can lead to a lot of blaming, shaming, and dysfunction in families as a consequence. Like, it can lead to lots of other things that I've noticed happening too in the Facebook groups that are formed around all of this work. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people following each other in this space too. So it's just something to bear in mind, isn't it, that you can get really stuck in that mindset.
Yeah, and I think that's one of my concerns. So I think, you know, it's a very delicate balancing act. You want to acknowledge the fact that traumatic things have happened and have contributed to your distress, your suffering, your problems, but you don't necessarily want to make trauma the center of your identity going forward forever. And that's one of my reasons, which some might find controversial, that I think the definition of the term trauma has, I think, broadened a bit too far sometimes, because once you see something as trauma, it sort of implies you've been broken. It implies that there's been this life-changing, you know, definitive experience which from which, you know, you are forever broken. And I think that's not the best way to think about things in some cases. Not to deny that terrible traumas can have terrible long-lasting effects. Of course, that's true. But if you make it central to who you are, you'll never fully recover. And sometimes recovery is possible, and I'm not always sure the trauma framing is the most beneficial one that way, especially when it's constantly being refreshed and circulated and intensified on social media.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I was reading, watched an amazing thing on SBS On Demand last night called The YouTube Effect, and how the algorithms are really driving this narrative around negative experiences, which are really starting to radicalize people and create these bubbles where you start to be only in that bubble, and that's the only thing you're being fed on your phones and on your laptops and on your devices. So I think that's a critical point that you raise there, because you won't even realize it. You won't be getting all the positive stories around other things or other ways of thinking, because that's not how the algorithms are working. YouTube, all of them, Instagram, you name it, that's what's happening. And Congress even had them saying, look what happened on January the 6th to the leaders of these companies, and there's no one doing anything about that. So I don't know how we combat that. I was thinking that about that this morning.
Yeah, it's no simple matter, but I think you're entirely correct about this. And look, these things are actually causing significant problems, these algorithms. So I've got a terrific colleague called Scott Griffiths, who's in my department, who does work with TikTok. And he basically shows that the algorithm is directing people who have particular problems to more content that is likely to, he's focusing especially on eating behavior and body image. And it's intensifying the problems that people have. And as you say, this occurs in all sorts of areas, you know, creating echo chambers and bubbles and the like. But when it's in the mental health space, it really can intensify distress and embed people in problems and deepen those problems. What you do about it, I mean, clearly it has to require some sort of regulation. Yes. Simply making people aware of it's often not enough, I think.
That's what I'm seeing too. And also they talked about, I see on with parents with in the tech world with kids now on phones at 18 months old, being able to navigate YouTube. And so often the parents think that YouTube kids is safe. But on the documentary last night, they showed how the algorithms of causing even YouTube kids to get things like telling kids how to kill themselves and things like this, that it's happening. And I don't know if you're aware, Nick, but in Australia, we're the leading country for online child exploitation with sextortion and children sharing adult material or taking photos of each other and stuff like that now. So that's also happening. And there's no doubt that we know that social media has contributed a lot to the eating disorders pandemic that's happening in Australia as well, because our regulations here in Australia are zero, and we don't even have any parental controls on our phones or anything, compared to even the US, where they have some form of trying to get parents some access to controlling these things. But yeah, I think that's a really big exponential thing that's happening in Australia as well. I really liked reading your piece in the inside story around grief and anger. And often we like to, we don't like these emotions often. We like people to get over their grief quickly, and we don't like people being angry in some ways. But you talk about it on the flip side, and its purpose of, you know, for good. And I think about that a lot too now. And do you want to share your perspective about that? Because I think they're really important perspectives for people to understand.
But, you know, I think, you know, grief is something that we're supposed to have. I mean, grief is the price you pay for loving someone and caring about someone. And this idea that you should sort of get over it and that you should sort of be stoical and suppress it and not express it is so unhealthy. In a society that requires us to sort of stifle these feelings is harming us. I mean, grief is an awful experience, but it's obviously a healing one as well. And very often, a lot of these so-called negative emotions are actually, you know, very functional, very doing a lot of good for us. So they're negative. They're often called negative within psychology, as if they're bad. But it just simply means they're subjectively unpleasant at the time. I mean, you would rather not be grieving. You would rather not be angry at a particular time. But that doesn't mean they're not serving useful, quite, you know, healing or growth promoting sort of functions. So the grieving is obviously allowing you to process the fact of your loss. And if it's interrupted or, you know, or suppressed by stoicism, it's not going to be nearly as effective, and it probably will last longer. And anger even isn't really a negative emotion. I mean, I think anger does a lot of bad things. Don't get me wrong. Anger can motivate, you know, hostility and violence and all of these things we'd rather not have. But anger is actually, in some respects, a positive emotion. It's actually motivating you to approach things rather than to avoid them. I mean, most negative emotions involve avoiding things, you know, staying away from the fear, staying away from the dangerous thing, and you know, loss, stay away from the sadness or the loss as much as possible. But anger is, you know, confront, approach, assert, deal with actively. And often, you know, anger can be quite enjoyable. People might sort of look as if they're unhappy, but actually, because it's a moral emotion, it's an emotion about I'm right and you're wrong, got this sense of, you know, righteous indignation going on, and you're telling someone a lesson, you're being dominant, and often you're asserting your rights. And if you don't have anger, you're not going to improve the world, because being submissive never changed anything. So I think, I'm not sure this is what I was writing in that review Selena, but I think it's all, you know, just trying to complicate our sense about what so-called negative emotions are, because a lot of negative emotions can have positive effects as well as negative ones.
Yeah, and I have to say, I just interviewed an amazing guy on my podcast. He started this company called Talking Stories. So he did the talking story for Hummingbird House, interviewing the parents that are losing their children, very young children, to cancer, and going on that journey. And what he discovered with grief was actually extreme love. Mm. So this extreme love, grief is the price of love, because you don't grieve something you don't love, kind of thing. So that was really, I thought that was fabulous. And on the anger front, I have to say that I noticed in August, I got extremely angry because all of a sudden I got told about what was happening in Australia to children online. And that really made me extremely angry inside. That anger, I transformed my book I was writing on parent. I was doing a book for parents and carers on thriving minds and neuroscience, introducing them to serve and return relationships and all of this around neuroplasticity. And then all of a sudden, in 1 month, I completely rewrote my book and I changed it to Parenting Children in the Tech Age, because we have to do something. We have to do something in Australia to protect our children online. And no one is. We don't have billboards out with kids smoke. We don't let our children smoke cigarettes. But at the moment in Australia, they're being set that what if you knew what was happening, and I got told about this through experts. Madonna King just put out a new book called Saving Our Kids about Task Force Argos, John Rouse's work in Queensland. He's been doing this for 20 years, and 2023 has got so bad. and they're targeting young boys. And that just and I just think about anger. Without that anger, I would not have rewritten that book.
Yeah, that's such a great story because it just shows anger's energizing. It galvanizes action. You know, it's not the running away emotion. It's the, you know, it's go forward and attack. And it gives you this energy and, you know, your juices are flowing. And yeah, you know, it led to extraordinary productivity in your case, which had you just been blasé or had you given up or been pessimistic or hopeless, you wouldn't have done. And we wouldn't have this book. So yeah, I think anger's a very fine emotion to have. I think Marte says that somewhere in his book as well.
He does.
You know,
it's
a good point to make.
Well, you are right to be angry if you weren't given the love and attention you need as a child, because you're so unprotected between the ages of 0 and 3, and parents don't realize that they've never been shown how to parent. You know, you just parent the way your parents parented, and some of it's good, some of it's bad, but yeah. Anyway. So I like some of his work too. I just think when you take anything to an extreme, it always ends up being a cult. And then as soon as you end up in that category, people start to bow down and stop being curious. And I think as you and I are scientists as well, you have to maintain that question mark, don't you? Because I can tend to bow down to something where it looks like it's really helping lots of people. But then you have to be so careful. Everyone, I guess what I always say to people that are listening, you've got to be able to keep asking questions of who you're talking to and of yourself. Just keep asking questions so that you stay open-minded at least. If this is working, fabulous. But if it starts to be where you're not allowed to ask a question or that it's starting to become you're starting to lose friendships, or you know what I mean? Like if it's starting to become not good for you, that's when you know you've got to step away a little bit. I think that's the key, isn't it, in all of this?
I think so. I think curiosity is the most important virtue. I mean, I'd go that far away, you know, that far and say, I think just staying open-minded, wanting to learn more is important. And look, you can also take that too far, of course. I mean, you can sort of never come to any conclusion because you're always thinking, oh, there might be some other perspective on that. So you, at some point you have to take action as well. But as you say, you got to be open to having your mind changed and to learning something new. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck.
So for readers that are going to get your book, Troubled Minds, and maybe people listening that either are encountering mental health challenges personally or within their close circle, what message do you hope they could take away from your book?
Well, probably a couple of messages. One is the experiences you're having are widely shared. There are people who know a lot about them and who've been trained to help those who suffer the things you're suffering. And, you know, help is available. So your experience is probably unique in some ways, but it's also shared in other ways. And there is expert knowledge about this. We hope that by reading the book, they'll identify the nature of the problems they have and the kind of solutions that they might seek. So I guess it's some mixture of hoping that people recognize themselves in the book and get a message of hope that there are things that can be done about it.
And do you want to give some ideas around or some insights from your book that some proactive steps that individuals might be able to take that are listening?
Taking time, talking to other people. I mean, social connection is obviously the key. A lot of people, especially guys, think that the solution is just to sort of bottle things up and deal with it themselves and be self-reliant. And that, look, I think self-reliance is a great thing. Don't get me wrong. But very often, I think the solution is to be found is to be open to someone else and just talk to them about your experiences. Often people anticipate that others will look down on them or laugh at them or just be unsympathetic. And very often you find, to your surprise, that other people are very open to it, have experienced something similar themselves, simply reaching out and talking honestly about your own experiences is often the very best step. I mean, there's a range of other things you can do in terms of, you know, relaxation and mindfulness and taking time for yourself and blah, 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 blah. A lot of general advice we've got one chapter, which is at the very end of the book about some of these concrete things you can do to enhance your coping with everyday life. But I think I'm a social psychologist really by training, more so than a clinical one. And I think the importance of social relationships, the importance of social connection, overcoming loneliness by forging better relationships with others, and just making use of the relationships you have, that's really a very large part of what matters. And the research backs this up as well. Social support is more powerful than pretty much any medication.
Yes, and I'm going to double down on that, 10x what you said, because it's the key, because we're a social species. I just interviewed Hugh Mackay, and we are a social species, which is our beautiful strengths. It's also our weaknesses. But everyone listening, if you can just reach out to one person, it will make all the difference in the world. And if it's men out there, there are so many places now that we never used to have to. Like, there's the Men's Shed, there's Well Team in South Australia, who have an app that it's all dedicated for men as well. I've noticed on the Sunshine Coast there are men's groups meeting on morning for coffee, just to have a chat. So there is lots and lots of ways if you don't feel open to reaching out to someone close right now. But I highly, highly recommend and back up what Nick said. 100% is what I've come to learn, is that's the most important thing. Just one person that can listen to you can almost overcome so many things. It's incredible, because of our social species, nature, such a great thing that you said. So I just want to back that up, because I think that piece we often overlook in search of these high resilient, tough it out, I'm just going to go and do this on my own and it's going to work out.
Yeah, and I think or technical solutions, thinking that there's some sort of miracle medication or psychotherapy that will solve things. And look, sometimes these things are highly effective, but even just basic things like you said.
So as we look forward, Nick, do you want to talk a little bit what you're working on? What advancements do you see coming? What do you anticipate in the field of mental health? And how does this align at all with what you've written about?
Look, I think that's a big big question, that one, where it's all heading. I'm not really sure where it's all heading, to be completely honest, despite supposedly being an expert. I mean, there's so many different trends going on all at once. There's more and more attention to systemic issues, and to sort of kind of, you know, especially here in Victoria, trying to just change the whole system and to incorporate the voices of people with lived experience. I think that's obviously a major step forward. And look, in our very small way, with our case studies in the book, we're trying to do that, saying the experience of people who've gone through mental ill health and treatment and haven't always had great experiences with professionals, that's important to hear. So there's going to be systemic change. There's all of these alternative ways of conceptualizing mental health. There's the whole neurodiversity movement. I'm not really sure where that's going, but that's expanding sort of into the territory that would once have been psychiatry's territory, and proposing an entirely new way of thinking, some would argue, about the nature of some problems. I think, the recognition of the importance of the social cure, as you were talking about, the belonging is becoming more and more important. I think we're going to have more and more attempts to do sort of prevention-related work that recognises the fact that we live in communities and isn't just focused on one-to-one treatment, like so much professional training in psychology and psychiatry has been, dealing with, you know, the small number of people, relatively small number of people who are suffering from clinical levels of distress, and focusing more on vulnerability. Is it going to be more and more work which is trying to use, you know, online tools, not just to do the evil things that they're currently doing that you talked about, but actually as a tool for good? So I think that's going to be a sort of way of the future. I mean, there's so many new directions. There's more attention than ever. I guess the one thing, maybe to put a slightly sour note on some of this, that I'm doing in my own work, and it didn't really come into the book in any way, but it's just my own research, with some PhD students, we're doing some work on changes in people's concepts of mental health, and looking at how those concepts have changed over time, and looking at the implications of holding sort of broader rather than narrower understandings about what mental illness is. So some people have a very broad concept, by which we mean that they include a very wide range of experiences as being involving mental illness. They have a fairly low threshold for what counts as mental illness. A lot of what you or I might think is just everyday suffering or distress, some people see as illness. Other people have very narrow concepts. And we've sort of found a way to measure differences between people in the expansiveness of those concepts. And we're trying to see whether those differences might impact how people respond to life stresses. There's a terrific Oxford University psychologist called Lucy Foakes, who's made the argument recently that although mental health awareness campaigns are incredibly important in spreading the word and making people aware of things, they may also be backfiring sometimes and leading some people to see ordinary problems in living as clinical disorders that need to have clinical interventions, leading to an excessive self-diagnosis and leading to people to lose resilience rather than gain resilience. And look, we don't yet have any strong scientific evidence that this is true, but I think it's a real concern because as mental health awareness has grown, there's been so much more of it, as knowledge has spread, that's led some people, I think especially younger people, to think that mental illness is everywhere and to have a pretty low threshold for identifying it. And if that's backfiring and having negative side effects, we need to do something about it.
Yeah, that's I could not agree more. I mean, I'm totally for reducing stigma and raising awareness, but I'm definitely on the healing, resilience, neuroplasticity side of the line because life is so short and we really want to help people thrive across their lifespan. And if we have a focus just down on one pathway but not on the other pathway, then we're losing sight of helping everyone thrive as a society, because if we want to tackle big things like climate change and all these other things, we have to have thriving people. We can't have people just thinking, that's what I'm seeing anyway. Young people are just distressed and think that there's no point anyway because of the algorithms, but also because of this focus on so many aspects now that I think are coming in an unscientific way to impact people and their thought processes around all sorts of things, which I don't want to label because then people get upset about it, but it really has become a very much a labeling thing now of everything.
Yeah, and look, labels can be helpful, but labels can also be dangerous. And so you've got to, I think, use them carefully, as you said. And look, amen to everything you just said.
Yeah, so thank you, Nick. Thank you so much for all your writings. Really extensive. People, I'll put the link to your website so people can go and find everything you've written, and really appreciate all the work you're doing. I think that new area is going to be really fruitful, and thank you.
Thank you very much. I love being on this show, and thanks for all the wonderful questions.
You're welcome.